The headlines. The White House National Security Advisor says Washington's priority is to deal with what he calls an escalating nuclear crisis with Iran. Bangladesh sends hundreds more Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote island despite opposition from rights groups. And tens of thousands of Indian farmers angry over the government's agricultural policies go on a hunger strike. Well, welcome to our studios near the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Top aide to U.S. President Joe Biden says the new administration's priority is to deal with what he calls an escalating nuclear crisis with Iran. The White House National Security Advisor claimed that Tehran is moving closer to having enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. Jake Sullivan made the remarks as the Biden administration has signaled that it wants to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal the previous administration had abandoned. Sullivan did not mention Biden's often stated precondition that Iran make the first move by resuming its full compliance with its commitments under the deal. Iran has underlined that it was the United States that unilaterally pulled out of the 2015 deal, and therefore it needs to take the first step by lifting sanctions and complying with the terms of the agreement. Political commentator Jason Unruh says that it was the U.S. that sabotaged the Iran nuclear deal and should not expect the Islamic Republic to comply with the agreement first.
The United States is the one who left the agreement. They are the ones who sabotaged the good faith agreement that existed, yet expects Iran to be the one who makes the overture to return to a more stable and peaceful situation. But it was the United States who was the one who actually violated the agreement. So the way that this is phrased is as though Iran did something wrong. Why should Iran trust the United States on a return to the agreement? Why should they have to take the first step when they were not the ones who left it? It was the U.S. People are questioning the commitment and the solidarity that the United States has to the agreement. And even then, Iran has taken no terribly radical action that would place anyone in danger anywhere in the global situation.
Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Ankara have a common stance that the only way to restore stability in the region is through synergy. Mohammad Javad Zarif hailed his talks with Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu as constructive, friendly, and fruitful. Zarif also noted that ways to expand bilateral ties, regional cooperation, and the latest developments in Syria, Iraq, and the Caucasus were among the main topics discussed in the talks. Iran's top diplomat made the remarks in a Twitter post at the end of his visit to Turkey.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says it is the duty of the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and fulfill its obligations under the accord. In a joint press conference with his Turkish counterpart, Zarif underlined that the moment the United States fulfills its commitments, Iran would be prepared to fulfill ours.
It is the duty of the United States to return to this agreement and to fulfill its obligations. The moment the United States fulfills its commitments, we would prepare to fulfill ours.
Zarif also denounced a U.S. decision last month to slap sanctions on Turkey over the country's purchase of the S-400 Russian air defense system. He said the sanctions have no significance. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zarif hailed relations with Turkey, noting that ties will deepen when the U.S. adopts more reasonable attitudes. For his part, Çavuşoğlu said, Turkey has always supported the nuclear deal, expressing the hope that the Biden administration would return to the JCPOA and lift sanctions on Iran.
I hope that with the Biden administration, the United States' return to this agreement and cooperation on the nuclear issue is restored. In this way, God willing, the sanctions and embargoes imposed on brotherly Iran are lifted.
Zarif arrived in Turkey as part of a tour of countries of the South Caucasus, aimed at building support for the creation of a regional platform that would include Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and encourage cooperation between the countries. The initiative was proposed following a ceasefire agreement in November that halted weeks of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the separatist territory of Nagorno-Karabakh.
العلاقة التركية إيرانية واضحة.
I think the meeting was very important. Both sides have a lot in common and many issues were discussed regionally and economically. The most important issue on the agenda was the Iran nuclear deal. And now with the new US administration, there is a hope for this deal to be revived.
Zarif also met with Turkish President Erdogan, where the two discussed expansion of bilateral ties, as well as regional cooperation in Syria, Iraq, Caucasus, and ways to restore stability in the region through synergy. This meeting is seen by many as a door to open negotiations between Turkey and the U.S. to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Bangladesh has sent another batch of Rohingya Muslim refugees to remote islands in the Bay of Bengal, despite opposition from rights groups. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. This is the newest addition to the roughly 3,500 refugees already sent to the island since early December. Dhaka claims it is only moving those who are willing to leave the overcrowded camps in the town of Cox's Bazar. However, humanitarian groups say the refugees have been forced to leave. The UN has also criticized the relocation, saying that the world body has not been allowed to evaluate the living conditions on the flood-prone island. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims crossed into Bangladesh after Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown on the stateless ethnic minority group in 2017. Indian farmers protesting against the government's controversial agricultural reforms have gone on a day-long mass hunger strike near the capital, New Delhi. Farm leaders are saying that Saturday's hunger strike, coinciding with the death anniversary of the country's independence icon Mahatma Gandhi, which showed their protests are peaceful. Farmers have been holding rallies and sit-ins outside and inside the capital, New Delhi, for the last 4 months. They also held a tractor rally on this week's Republic Day that turned violent, leaving one person dead and hundreds injured. Farmers want the government to repeal the legislation passed in September, arguing that it would leave them at the mercy of big corporations. The government claims the measure is aimed at boosting rural incomes. Nearly a dozen rounds of talks between the two sides have failed to make a breakthrough. The U.S. military has slammed recent Chinese military flights over the South China Sea as destabilizing. The U.S. military's Pacific Command says the flights over the past week are, quote, aggressive behavior. It says, however, the fighter jets pose no threat to a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier strike group in the region. The group led by the USS Theodore Roosevelt entered the South China Sea recently amid tensions between China and Taiwan. Taipei last week reported an incursion by Chinese warplanes into its air defense identification zone. The U.S. condemned the alleged move, urging China to stop pressuring Taiwan. Beijing considers the self-ruled island as part of its territory and is critical of Washington's boosting ties with Taipei. The U.S. and South Korea plan to carry out joint military exercises this spring, drawing international calls for the drills to be suspended. Nearly 400 activist organizations in South Korea and around the world signed a joint statement calling on the new U.S. President Joe Biden to suspend the exercises, even as military officials in Seoul and Washington suggested the maneuvers would go ahead. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Joint military drills involving the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to go ahead this spring, says South Korea's Minister of Defense and military officials under U.S. President Joe Biden. But nearly 400 NGOs around the world have signed a joint statement calling for the drills to be scrapped, in the hopes of improving relations with North Korea and promoting a lasting peace. The annual exercises, some of which are computer-simulated war games, are viewed by Pyongyang as a threat and a rehearsal for invasion.
The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises have been suspended before, in the early 1990s, as Washington sought to improve relations with Pyongyang. Previous U.S. President Donald Trump also scaled back the drills following his first summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in 2018.
The North's Kim then pledged to suspend nuclear and long-range missile testing, with subsequent meetings between Kim and Trump failing to yield results or much for North Korea in return for its moratorium. U.S.-led sanctions against Pyongyang remain in place. South Korea keeps buying more advanced U.S. weapons, and now more military exercises are planned. Some activists view the war drills as counterproductive.
These South Korea-U.S. joint exercises fail to contribute to maintaining peace. Rather, it has been conducted in a way that threatens peace on the Korean Peninsula. It's now even more important because it's the beginning of the new Biden government in the United States and what signals can give to North Korea at this point.
North Korea has continued developing other military technologies, introducing a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a recent military parade. While seemingly committed to the drills, new U.S. officials have said they're reviewing North Korea policy, as experts call on Pyongyang to be patient. Frank Smith, Press TV, Seoul.
8 Afghan security personnel are killed as a bomber drives a vehicle loaded with explosives into a military base in the country's east. The pre-dawn assault took place in the rest of the province of Nangarhar. The provincial council confirmed the attack, but put the number of dead soldiers at 15. The Taliban militant group has claimed responsibility. The attack came 2 days after the Pentagon said that the Taliban were not living up to promises made in a deal signed with Washington last year. Under the agreement, the U.S. pledged to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan. In return, the Taliban agreed to not allow extremists to operate from the country and give some security guarantees. Violence has surged in recent months, despite Doha peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government. A team of experts led by the World Health Organization, tasked with investigating the origins of the COVID-19, has begun field visits in the Chinese city of Wuhan. After a two-week quarantine, the team paid a visit to one of Wuhan's main hospitals, which treated patients in the early stages of the pandemic. The team is also scheduled to visit labs, markets, and other hospitals during its remaining days in the city. China has warned against any political interference in the mission. The investigators arrived in Wuhan on January 14. To make sure that they are not exposed to the disease, they spent 14 days in a hotel, where they started the probe through online meetings with Chinese scientists. The first known cluster of coronavirus was detected in Wuhan in December 2019. Correspondent Stephen Rebe joined us earlier to give us the latest details about the WHO-led investigations into the origins of coronavirus pandemic in China.
Today they were driven to the Jinyin Tan Hospital, which received the first officially diagnosed COVID-19 patients at the end of 2019. The team leader, a team member, Peter Daszak, just said the hospital visit was an important opportunity to talk directly with medics who are on the ground at that critical time fighting COVID. The WHO has been kind of managing expectations. Michael Ryan, their emergencies director, said success is not measured necessarily in absolutely finding a source on the first mission. So he's warning against expecting too much. It's important to note that as the Chinese have warned, this is a very politicized. America wants to muster global opinion against China, so it will be looking to use this visit to its advantage. China, meanwhile, of course, doesn't want a result that will make it look bad. And the team member Daszak has acknowledged this. He said that he's aware that this is a very sensitive working environment and that every side has something to lose in this investigation.
Italian workers have gone on a strike to protest over the government's handling of the COVID crisis. Correspondent in Rome, Max Giovilli, has more.
Public and private sector workers staged a nationwide 24-hour general strike to denounce government measures adopted to counter the spread of coronavirus disease in Italy. The industrial action, called by the Confederation of Base Unions COBAS, was joined by public servants and self-employed workers in several cities, including Milan, Rome, and Naples. In a note, unions have explained that the ongoing health crisis has exacerbated a structural crisis of the capitalist economy, with a generalized impoverishment and a worsening of living conditions for millions of male and female workers. Also, students and teachers of Italian high schools held rallies in Rome and other cities, demanding a prompt return to the classroom after almost 10 months of remote learning.
We are staging a protest to reiterate that schools must be a priority in this country. Just a small amount of the recovery fund is destined to the school system. Students are sick and tired of distance learning and are dropping out of schools. Many are falling victim to depression.
Students across Italy have been holding demonstrations, open-air lessons and strikes in protest over the adoption of the distance learning policy by the government in response to a second wave of COVID-19 in October. About 10 million students have been affected by coronavirus restrictions in Italy, while schools have remained open in most European countries.
We demand more classrooms, transport to school, and better access to education. Distance learning is not working. Many families cannot afford providing digital devices to their children to attend internet lessons regularly. Our families get poorer by the day as our parents lose their jobs.
As if the COVID crisis and its grave effects on the Italians weren't enough, Italy has also been hit by a political crisis, with Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resigning earlier this week, forcing the country's head of state to start a round of formal consultations with all political groups to establish if a new government majority can be formed.
Talks between Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and party leaders to resolve the government crisis concluded on Friday, with the country on the brink of a crashing socio-economic failure. President Mattarella must now decide on the way forward and ensure Italy a new government. Max Civili, Rome.
And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols help to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. This is Aperture. In response to the sustained and increasingly visible violence against black communities in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement took shape. The movement campaigns against police violence and systematic racism towards African Americans. People from all walks of life in the Black Lives Matter campaign regularly protest police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Eric Garner went unconscious.
Cops used a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
His death not being called a homicide.
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island. Representing the Black Lives Matter movement, blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles, but protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem, it's a New Jersey problem, it's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance, but I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for Black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida. Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? Well, one reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen were going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations. It appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us, it appears as excessive. But for the officer, at a given moment on the street, it wasn't excessive. And the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage of the convenience store is not very, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African-American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African-American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes.
Let's arrest them and let's have them go before a jury of his peers,
yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story,
yeah.
Really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, critically about it, because regardless of what happens in the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening with a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, because I like
like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah. Absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet? And would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why. You know, I was screaming at the the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just
like shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
The Gardner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since the Gardner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on the shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility, but again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
They Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about color blindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
There's police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. We're here with you from IRRB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in. There's a very interesting hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. His Eminence was asked regarding love and whether this subject is in any way included in the context of religion. And the answer that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam gave, I think it could be set as a life mantra for all of us, as a dogma. We could write it on a huge billboard with gold and set it up in every city in the world to constantly remind ourselves of the importance of love. When asked about love in religion, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said, "Is religion anything but love?" To understand this hadith better, let's listen to a story and create some tangibility regarding this subject in our minds, and we will continue with our discussion in a short bit. Stay with us.
Traveling faster than messenger. Once Ayaz, the favored slave of Mahmud, the king, became ill due to the evil eye of courtiers who always envied Sultan Mahmud's favors upon him. Ayaz could not come to the court because of illness, as he was bedridden. When the news of his illness reached Sultan Mahmud, he called for his most loyal messenger to take the fastest horse and rush to Ayaz. "Although I'm far away from you, but in reality my soul is next to you. I have not forgotten about you, and your suffering is my own suffering," Sultan wrote in a message. Sultan ordered the messenger not to stop anywhere and avoid any delays. The messenger rode over the fastest possible horse without any breaks, but once he reached Ayaz, he was shocked to see that the Emperor Mahmud was already there at his bedside. The messenger shivered with fear, since he thought the Emperor will suspect that he disobeyed his order and took a rest during the journey. "Do not worry," replied Sultan, seeing messenger's facial expression. "I know you did not take rest, but how can anyone travel faster than one whose heart is captured by his beloved?"
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
If I were to say that love is the very essence of creation, I wouldn't be exaggerating. Whether it's the numerous ahadith that we have regarding the love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has toward His creations, whether it's the narrations regarding the love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has toward His noble prophet, and because of that love, we could say in a way an inspiration, creation was inspired. It is the very life source within every atom of this universe. Aside from the fact that He is the Almighty, He's the All-Knowing, He's the All-Wise, He creates because He is capable of creating. One must understand that He could have just created and He could have just left us, forsaken us. And provided for our basic needs, I mean, food, water, air, things that contribute to our biological growth. But the fact that He put for us a sort of spiritual journey, the fact that He set an objective for our creation and made it the very aim and philosophy of our existence, for us to have an origin, which is from Him, of course, and a return, for Him to create all the means and facilities necessary for that return, and equip us with all the means to find our way back to Him, to recognize the signs and pathways that would lead us toward Him. All of this is an indication that our creation goes beyond the borders of the necessity that Allah's wisdom and ability to create entails. We can say that, well, He knows best and He is the most powerful, thus that necessitates for it to manifest itself in the actual world, and creation was created. Sure, that could be an argument, but again, it's a very basic argument. It would not answer the question as to why we have been given some sort of a mission. That does not answer the question of what is the purpose and meaning of life. And in a nutshell, from what we can deduce from the narrations and the revelations and everything that all the prophets of God have brought forth from Him, we could very easily and simply say it is because of love. There's a hadith Qudsi, which is sort of a revelation from Allah. It's a narration from God, but it's not from the holy scriptures. It's not the Quran, it's not the Bible or Torah or things like that. But it's still a revelation. And in it, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala basically describes the process of the love which is exchanged between Him and His subject, His creation. And He talks about how when someone gets to know God and they gain ma'rifah and knowledge toward what Allah is, not that we can understand what He truly is, that is beyond our mind's capacity. But once we gain a certain level of ma'rifah toward Him, and we come to an understanding, perhaps a growing understanding of His attributes, we can't help but to love Him. This topic of love of Allah is something that we can talk about 3 years. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for tuning in. Until another greeting, we leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.